Welcome to the podcast on suicide risk factors and warning signs and what to do about them. Today we're talking with Jill Harkavy Friedman, who is Vice President of Research at the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. She's also an Associate Professor of Clinical Psychology in Psychiatry at Columbia University. Her primary focus has long been on suicidal behavior among adolescents and adults, as well as psychiatric diagnosis and assessment and research methodology. Welcome, Jill. It's great to have you here.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Let's start by, let me just ask you, what types of issues lead to suicidal thoughts or attempts?
Well, one thing I want to say is that suicidal thoughts are not infrequent. And just because someone's thinking about suicide does not mean they're necessarily going to act on it or even die by suicide. So that's the first thing I want to say, because we want people to share those thoughts so that we can help prevent suicide. But in general, suicidal ideation behavior is very complicated. There are many factors that come together, and there's no one cause. There are biological factors like genetics, family history of mental health conditions. There are psychosocial factors and depressed mood, early loss. There are all kinds of factors that go together, and under most circumstances, people will not engage in suicidal ideation and behavior. The part we usually see are the triggers, the stress factors that we attribute to, oh, this person is thinking of killing themselves because this happened or that happened. So that's the trigger, but it's important to know that there are things going on in the background all the time, and a person at risk may never actually have those thoughts or act on them.
Can you talk about what risk factors to watch out for that may actually be closer to somebody carrying out suicide?
Yeah, so I want to just make a distinction. There are risk factors. Those are things that increase the risk or likelihood that somebody might act on suicidal ideation. And those are things like there are long-term risks, like I mentioned, family history of mental health problems or suicide, genetics, early loss, brain trauma, those kinds of long-standing factors that can increase your risk for depression, for impulsive behavior, for poor decision-making. Then there are shorter-term risks, like being in the episode of depression, using substances frequently so that your judgment is impaired. And then there are triggers, and those are the events we see. So those are risk factors that underlie what might lead somebody to engage in suicidal behavior. Okay. But then there are the warning signs. Those are the things that we see. So a change in mood, a change to either greater depression or apathy, not caring about anything, lack of interest, or even agitation, are often an irritability. Those are often signs that somebody's not feeling well. On top of that, changes in appetite, either higher or lower, changes in sleep, either more or less, talking about being hopeless, feeling like you have no options, feeling like you're a burden, changes in uses of substances, usually drinking more, and a social withdrawal, pulling back from people. Those are the kinds of things you might see.
Okay. So what roles do anxiety and stress play in relation to suicidal behavior? Could just focus on that. And I think you've touched on genetics and the environment, if that plays a role at all.
Yeah, so just a word about the genetics. What we've come to find out is it's really what we call a gene-environment interaction. In other words, the genes may lay the groundwork for risk, but what happens in the environment can trigger the genes to function in a certain way. We still don't know everything about genes, so we have a long way to go. But two genetic groups that we do know about are those genes that are related to stress and how one copes with stress, in terms of reactivity to stress and resilience. So if you have the genetic makeup that makes you less resilient and more affected by stress, and then stress happens, there's a breakup, you lose a job, something where most people might fare well, in the context of all the other factors, you might be at greater risk for thinking about suicide. And the one really important point is just because you're thinking about it doesn't mean that you are going to act on it or that you have to act on it. We now have tools to help people.
Okay. The somebody who's struggling with suicidal thoughts, what is the first thing or the best thing for someone to do to you know, get those thoughts under control, to prevent them from carrying through with the suicide, if they're so inclined, if they're one of those people who actually might act on it? When, or I guess even if they're not going to act, let's just talk about suicidal thoughts and what people can do who are struggling with those.
When someone's struggling with suicidal thoughts, one of the most helpful things you can do is tell someone else. And if that person's uncomfortable with it or doesn't act in a helpful way, tell someone else. If that person doesn't help, you can also call the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 1-800-273-8255, because there's always somebody there who can talk with you, and they also hook up with local crisis lines. But the main thing is, don't keep it inside. Things get bigger when you keep them inside. When someone's thinking about suicide, it's usually because they're in tremendous pain and they want it to stop, whether it's emotional pain or physical pain. And now we have tools. There are tools that the person can use, like safety planning, mindfulness, all kinds of ways to manage the suicidal ideation so you don't act on it.
So let's get into that a little bit, the mental health interventions or treatments that have been effective.
Okay, so there are mental health interventions that have been that are looking to be very effective. And we think of them in several ways. So they're the short-term interventions. What can you do in a crisis moment? And then there are the longer-term interventions of how you can learn to manage and even reduce or eliminate suicidal ideation and behavior. So in terms of short-term interventions, one simple step is called a safety plan. And you can work it out. It helps if you're in mental health treatment, just because that person, A, has the tools to help you, and B, is objective. It's about helping you, and you don't have to worry about them. So a safety plan is pretty simple. You first figure out what sets you off, and then you make a list. What are things that you can do to help yourself, to distract yourself, so that you don't dwell on those thoughts and feelings? The next step, and these are not necessarily, you can start anywhere in this ladder, is to think, literally list people that you can call to distract yourself with. You don't necessarily have to talk about how you're feeling. The next is to list people that you can call and say, I'm really feeling crummy. I'm feeling like I don't want to exist anymore. And they can talk with you. Then there are the professionals that you can enlist, and then the emergency numbers like the Suicide Prevention Crisis Line, text line. And then finally, 911. So you set that up so that if that moment comes that you're thinking about it, you don't suddenly have to think about what can I do. Because when you're in that state, you're not thinking what can I do to feel better. You're thinking what can I do to end the pain.
So you would say, I'm feeling really bad. I'm going to just go to my safety plan.
Exactly. Okay. And people should be enlisted in your safety plan, and people literally put it on their refrigerators. There are apps like Safety Plan or Safety Net and My3. You can have it on your phone. So there's also some interim interventions. An example would be Collaborative Assessment and Management of Suicidality, called CAMS. So CAMS is an intervention that helps people when they're in interim or transition periods. For example, they've been discharged from the hospital, but they don't yet have an outpatient, haven't had an outpatient session. What we know is, what helps is focusing on the suicidal ideation behavior, understanding what triggers it, and then working on solutions for managing it. And then in the long term, there are interventions like dialectical behavior therapy, or DBT, you might have heard of, mm-hmm. cognitive behavior therapy, SP, which the SP stands for suicide prevention. There is attachment-based family therapy, which works well with kids and families. So there's a variety of evidence-based treatments at this point.
And in terms of the evidence-based treatments, if you could get a little specifics, let's say a patient is undergoing one of those, what can mm-hmm. they expect?
They can expect to work with their clinician. That's the first thing. These are all collaborative, because in the end, it's up to you. Nobody's going to be following you around every step of the way. And you have to decide that you may feel like you don't want to live, but you're going to keep trying even though you don't feel like it right now. And you're going to work with your clinician on how to do that. And so then each treatment has its own pathway, but generally it's agreeing to work on it, discussing the tools that are available to you and how you can personalize them for you, and then trying them, going out and coming back. In addition, it's always important to limit access to lethal means, because in that moment when you may be feeling less than on top of your game, you don't want anything there that makes it too easy. So you will talk with the clinician about how you can limit your access to means as well. The more you talk and share, the more likely it is that you're going to feel better. And sometimes that will also involve medication, because sometimes, you know, the brain is an organ. And in your organism working, sometimes you need biological interventions. And that will help the therapy that you're engaged in.
Okay. Let's talk about suicide prevention now a little bit. Family members, therapists, patients, everybody can play a role. Friends, I imagine. Can you address that and just give some tips for, I guess, for the patients and loved ones?
Yeah, because suicide affects everybody. It affects the person, but it also affects the family and the friends. And even if someone's not thinking about suicide, when they're struggling, it's hard for family and friends as well. So at the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, we've developed a simple brochure called Talk Saves Lives. And the material's on our website as well, AFSP.org. And again, it's about just asking that question. You don't start off with, are you thinking of killing yourself? But eventually you don't want to ignore that question. So just starting with, how are you doing? I noticed that you're not sleeping well, or you've been, you know, grumpy for longer than I would expect. Is something bothering you? Is something on your mind? And while you as a family member or a friend don't necessarily have the tools that a clinician has, you do have the ability to engage them and support them and encourage them to seek help. And that's the underlying message. Learn the warning signs. Check in with the people you care about. Check in with yourself, because you might be feeling that way as well. And then seek help and find a clinician that you feel comfortable working with.
Okay. Is there anything else that you would like to add?
I'd like to say that suicide is preventable. It is the result of somebody experiencing terrible pain and feeling as if that pain is never going to go away. And while we know it will go away, they don't feel that way. So we're on a mission for a world without suicide.
Wonderful. Great message. Thank you very much, Dr. Harkavy-Friedman. And this is Jean Kaplan-Tycro for ADAA.